Thank you. And good evening, everyone. Inheritance taxes. A pitiless hammer in the hands of a corrupt state. See, the state swings the hammer, and the hammer is inheritance taxes, is what happens. And tonight, we want to talk about that. How many of you have ever thought about the morality of inheritance taxes? And furthermore, I want to ask this question. In this group for tonight, all together, can we possibly think of a reason why the state has an interest in your inheritance? In other words, what legitimate interest does the state have in your inheritance? For example, I'd like to think the state does not have a legitimate inheritance in my income. Oh, wait a second. We have income tax, don't we? Yeah, we have income tax. And the state says it has a legitimate interest in what money you make. Now think about that. Just think. What moral imperative does the state have? What moral reason does the state have to worry about how much money you make? The same question must be asked about inheritance taxes. But the state does have what they believe is a moral imperative. They do have a reason to worry about how much you make and how much you pass on to your peers. Now, don't worry about the numbers here, but here you see a group of family members sitting around, and I get it's a cartoon, but apparently they just found out just how much the inheritance taxes are going to take from what they thought they were going to receive from the deceased, and it looks like they've are a little surprised at what they've learned. Here we have another cartoon, and this one I like a little bit better. Yes, we have. We're cremating Dad here, and Dad's going up in flames, and guess what else is going up in flames? Our estate is following Dad right into the cremation bin there. Now, someone's going to say, hey, they're not taking it all. Yeah. Anybody know how the income tax started out? It's actually before the war actually got going, really. But the income tax was just to hit the rich, and it was never going to hit everybody else, and it was going to be a very, very small percentage. And it was. And as long as I don't have to be taxed, you see, don't tax you and don't tax me, tax that man behind the tree. Guess what? We're all behind the tree after a while. A little bit of numbers here, just a little bit. Don't worry so much about this. Look at this. If you have an estate worth $1 to $2.5 million, the federal government's get 5.5%, and the states get 2.1%. Charity gets 3.5%. Now, this is back in 2005, and I think this has changed a little bit. We'll see a few more numbers here. This is just a interesting little table here. It's from the IRS. A very reliable source, no doubt about it, when discussing total inheritance taxes. Now, someone's going to say, hey, what are you worried about, 5.5% and 2.1%? What are you worried about? Remember when we talked about taxes before here? We have discussed taxes, and we have talked about the morality of taxation and the morality of forced taxation. And if you and I cannot talk about taxes from a moral standpoint, we will lose every time. We will lose the discussion. Bernie Sanders. Hey, let's give everybody free college tuition. Somebody says, we can't do that because it costs too much. Boom, you've lost the argument right there. So it's over. Because now you're going to discuss about how much is too much. Instead, you should say, that's immoral. It's immoral to make somebody pay for somebody else's college education. And by the way, no one even can define an education nowadays anymore anyway. Do yourself a favor. Try to define an education. Do it. Is it a piece of paper with a little star on it? Tell you what, there's people that have no piece of paper with no star and a lot more educated than people that have it. What is even an education, and we're supposed to pay for it for someone else? It's immoral. It's godless. Here's a father explaining this to his son. Yeah. Try to figure that one out if you're the son. How's that work? Kind of means I got to sell 40% of it, right? Maybe I have to sell the whole thing, get 40% of my money from someplace else, borrow money to buy the estate back. You don't think that happens when people are selling farms? Happens all the time. It's immoral. It's godless. You can't see the whole thing here. I thought I had it adjusted. But here's his father, old guy. He's about to go by the boards, and he's explaining to his son. He said, you know, I'm sorry you have no inheritance left. I spent all your inheritance fighting the inheritance taxes, and there's no inheritance left for you, son. You know, it's kind of funny because we get it, right? We understand. Cost of dying. These are taxes. Japan, 55%. South Korea, 50%. France, 45%. UK, US. Bargain. Dying in the US, 40%. What a bargain. Now, again, this is kind of an average here because the more you leave to your heirs, the greater percentage the state gets. That's immoral on its face, isn't it? Well, why should the state get a greater percentage just because you had more to give away? You know, it's kind of intriguing about this. I was looking at this. I was thinking about this chart here. I was thinking, why is it that we, well, here's South Korea, 50%. Wonder what the percentage is in North Korea. Yeah, it's like zero or 100 or whatever, because nobody has anything to pass on. And you know, this is this insidious thing that we keep on seeing. It's insidious, because only the people that have anything to pass on, only the Western countries, you can see these are all Western countries here, even South Korea, Western influence. Only the people with anything to pass on have an inheritance tax. It's the same problem we have with Marxism, communism all the time, right? The leeches. The parasites only feed on the living. And all those countries where they destroy. I wonder what Venezuela's inheritance tax is. Nobody has any money in them there anymore. It is an insidious mess because these people, they attack freedom. They attack property. And then they tax the daylights out of it because the other people don't even have any. It is an insidious mess and an outrage. You knew this was coming. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. But the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. Much food is in the fallow ground of the poor, and for lack of justice there is waste. These two verses speak extensively to communism, Marxism, all that mess that we're fed daily by the media, by our educational elite. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. You want to be a good man? Right here we know how. Leave an inheritance to your children's children. But the state comes along and says, no, a good man is the one that leaves inheritance to us. They get to define good. But that second one, I want to talk about that. For lack of justice, there is waste. You know what we're told all the time? We're told that it's freedom. We're told that it's the family that wastes. I studied that this week. I was shocked. So I got a hold of some article that was arguing for inheritance taxes. I kid you not. You know what they argued? I'm not making this up. They argued that it's good we have inheritance taxes because that way people give more money to charity. I'm reading this paragraph again and again. Now, they couldn't prove it, but what they did was they went to a study that said that because of inheritance taxes, people give more money to charity. Hey, you know what? I think I'd like to see the study on the other end. You know what I mean? Which I don't think they had. How about we study people with no inheritance taxes for, I don't know, 500 years? Let's do that study and see how much money goes to charity. You see, we're told that thanks to the state, they stop waste. It's actually opposite of that. For lack of justice, there is waste. You see, waste is not about, you know, tuning up the economy and, you know, let's raise this tax and let's lay this tax on this group of people that can't defend themselves, like the tanning salons got it a few years ago. Remember that one? Yeah, let's get those guys. That'll stop the waste. Now, the Bible's really clear. There's waste when there's a lack of justice. Now, why would there be a connection between justice and waste? Why do you think that would be? And the answer is simple. Where there's justice, there's no theft, right? And where there's no theft, people work really, really hard to preserve the products of their work. The biggest enemy to to thrift is lack of justice. A lot more could be said about that. Probably should be a topic in the future. The power to tax involves the power to destroy, Chief Justice John Marshall. Keep in mind, that's not, taxing isn't destruction necessarily, but the power to tax is the power to destroy. Because the threat hangs over your head all the time. How many of you businessmen here, and how many of you know exactly what kind of tax you're going to be paying next year? And how many of you even have an idea of what bracket you're going to be in, you know, if you write this off or you do this extra job or whatever, you're going to be in some kind of crazy tax, and you're sitting back and saying, I don't know if I want to be that productive. Oh, maybe not. Maybe it's better just to sit back. You see, what's happening is the power hanging over your head to tax you is destroying your incentive to be productive. Believe me, destruction means the ability to be productive, right? Destruction and production are opposite ideas. Property is power. And the control of property is therefore the key to power. Basic to all control of property is the control of inheritance. According to the Columbia Encyclopedia, inheritance in law is the right to acquire property on the death of the owner. In Anglo-American law, inheritance is by the grace of the state, which may exercise any degree of control over the property of the decedent, that is, the owner who dies, including the total escheat, government acquisition of title, by the grace of the state. And how much grace does a state have? Since when has a state been the source of grace? By the grace of the state. I don't know about you, but I'm just feeling all kind of warm and fuzzy inside. The grace of the state. When the state enters into the question of inheritance, property gradually is transferred from the family to the state. The key word there is gradual. Yeah. It's a few percentage points right now, or a lot. Do you think that's going to go down anytime soon? The inheritance tax is simply a first step in that program of confiscation. For the family to maintain itself, the family must control inheritance, and the biblical laws of inheritance are entirely family laws. Do you ever think about that? In the scriptures, there is no law of inheritance that doesn't involve a family. None. No law of inheritance involves the state, and no law of inheritance involves the church. All family. All of it. The Bible kept property immune from taxation and from anything but family control of inheritance. According to Carl C. Zimmerman and Lucius F. Cervantes, in their study, Marriage and Family, Western Society had a family organization since Christianity became the faith of the West. A man's life from birth to death is guided, affected, and colored by family relations. The basic unit of the social order is the family. The family is a social stable unit where the family has liberty and property. As a result, the totalitarians, the statists, hate the family and declare it to be the enemy of social change. Totalitarianism hates the family because it is the basic thesis of all totalitarians that man's first loyalty must be to the state, whereas the Christian family's first allegiance is to the triune God. The totalitarian therefore seeks to abolish the family. Lenin said, "No nation can be free when half the population is enslaved in the kitchen." Look at this. As a result, the communist state abolished the family as a legal entity until 1936, and the family since then has merely been a legal breeding ground for the state. The Soviet Union, 2 years after the revolution, just 2 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, announced the family has ceased to be a necessity. Women were freed. Well, look at this. Women were freed from the kitchen only to become the unskilled labor force of the Soviet Union. And don't think that's not anything but completely true. Because when they talk about freeing the mom to be, you know, out of the, from the slavery of the kitchen and from the slavery of the home, as Marx talked about it, and Lenin did as well. Marx, there's a big thing with Marx. He called marriage slavery. All he's really talking about doing there is taking him out of here and making him a slave over here. That's all he was doing. And I don't know if you've ever seen, if you've ever read, how many here have read The Gulag Archipelago by Solzhenitsyn? Okay, if you get a chance, it's a thick book like this, you don't have to read everything. Do like I do. Okay, I did read it, but do like I do with some books. Look at the pictures. If you get a hold of one of his original copies, look at the pictures. And one of the saddest things is the amount of women that they got out of the home and out of the kitchen that were slave laborers in those Soviet fields. And you will see horrifying pictures. Pictures of young girls pulling plows. We got the same thing today. We're being told the exact same thing as what Marx and Lenin said. The family is slavery. Therefore, we're going to attack the slavery family through all kinds of means. And all they really want to do is they want to grab the family and make it their slaves. That's all they're doing. And that's what happens through inheritance tax, my friends. If slavery, I got into this discussion recently at work. If slavery really is the property of another man, is that I have a legitimate property in another man's labor, if that's what slavery is, then inheritance taxes is slavery, at least to the extent that you have to pay them. Because the state says they have a legitimate property in your labor that it took to make that money that gets passed on when you die. You see, I want to make this as clear, and I know that I don't make this as clear as I'd like to. I know that I don't. But the reason why they hate the family so much is they see it as competition to them. That's why. They will never get the power they want as long as the family exists. And I'll tell you what, they look at the money that you get to save in inheritance taxes as money that they could legitimately get their hands on if they were really as nasty as they felt like they could be. Every dime that you save, that you pass on to your heirs, is what the status look at is, you know what, we're giving that up. That really belongs to us, but we'll be nice. We'll be benign, and you guys can keep a little bit of money. Thanks a lot. Five questions. What is it about the family that modern man, via the state, hates so much? Second, what is the issue at the core of the conflict between the state and the family? Why the war against the family via inheritance taxes? How does the state wage war against the family? And what critical aspect of family responsibility is lost when the family is deprived of property? Feel good tonight, friends. I had 10 of these, but I cut it down to 5. But all of them have an A and B. No, I'm just kidding. Number one, what is it about the family that modern man via the state hates so much? And this is probably going to be a little bit of an odd answer for you, but stick with me on this. The family represents a specific observable certainty, a visible absolute that thoroughly offends the relativist. Remember this. The first major state conflict that we read about in the Bible was stopped by the family, not the state. The family is a certainty. You, my friends, you cannot be a relativist like what's teaching in our social science centers. You can't be a relativist and accept the sanctity of the family. You can't do it. You have to say that the family's evolving just like everybody else. Therefore, the pervs can invade the bathrooms. Because we're evolving. But the family as God ordained it, represents a certainty. And relativists cannot handle certainties. Look at this. We've talked about this before. When Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, and this is that fight that happened that Abram got involved in between the king of Sodom and Gomorrah and some other guys, he armed his trained servants. Check this out. Born in his own house. 318 and pursued them unto Dan, and divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, and smote them, and pursued them to Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the woman also, and the people. My friends, this is the first war in Scripture. And you know what? It wasn't settled by one state. It was settled by a family man. A man who had trained servants in his own house. It was settled by a family. If you are looking to the state to solve the problems of the state, that had already been tried, right? Four kings had already fought five kings. They were all kicking each other's lights out. They grab Lot and take him off and all his goods. And the goods were gone. They were never going to be recovered except for one man, one family man named Abram. And he's the one, and I love this. And he brought back all the goods and also brought again his brother and his goods and the women also and the people. Don't you just really like those words? Those are wonderful words. It's the family that's been bringing back all the goods since the beginning of time. And it's the state that's getting in their way. As they did here. And we're told that if it wouldn't be for the benevolent state, we wouldn't have anything. Why, we'd all be poor. Got to read the Bible. Are you getting why the statists hate the Bible so much? Secondly, what is the issue at the core of the conflict between the state and the family? It is an issue of service. Pharaoh clearly saw that the moment the Israelites served God, they would or could no longer serve him. Now, this is when the children of Israel are trying to get out of Egypt. Now, we've talked about this before. Let's talk about it again. And the Lord said unto Moses, Go unto Pharaoh, and say unto him, Thus saith the Lord, Let my people go, that they may serve me. Now, Pharaoh was in charge of probably the most powerful man living. Do you think that might have been just a little offensive right there? They may serve me. And the Lord said unto Moses, This is Exodus 8. Rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh. Lo, he comes forth to the water and saying to him, Thus says the Lord, Let my people go, that they may serve me. Then the Lord said unto Moses, Go unto Pharaoh and tell him, Thus says the Lord God of the Hebrews, Let my people go, that they may serve me. That's Exodus 9:1. And the Lord said unto Moses, Rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh and saying to him, Thus says the Lord God of the Hebrews, Let my people go, that they may serve me. Exodus 8. And he said, Tomorrow. And he said, Be it according to thy word, that thou mayest know that there is none like unto the Lord our God. Now look at this. I want you to see what Moses is saying here. Because we ask ourselves, what is the point of the conflict between Moses, Pharaoh, God, and so forth? Well, here we have an idea of it. Let's say that we want Moses to know, or Pharaoh to know, that there's none like unto the Lord our God. And we get that from Exodus 8:10. And from Exodus 9:14, For I will this time send all my plagues upon thine heart, and upon thy servants, and upon thy people, that thou mayest know that there is none like me in all the earth. So we have the same terminology, right? In Exodus 9, none like me in all the earth. And Exodus 8, there's none like me, none like unto the Lord our God. Okay, so that's pretty similar language there. Okay, so this is Pharaoh's going to get this point. Now let's look at something else, though. There's another point coming. Exodus 9, 29. Same chapter here, but the emphasis is going to change, I think, rather dramatically. And Moses said unto him, as soon as I am going out of the city, I will spread abroad my hands unto the Lord, and the thunder shall cease. This is during one of the plagues. Neither shall there be any more hail, that thou mayest know that the earth is the Lord's. Why would Pharaoh have to know that the earth is the Lord's? Let me ask you something. For our modern status, I ask you this question. Who, if you were to ask them who they think the earth belongs to, what do you think your modern status would say? Your modern congressman? Your modern bureaucrat? Your modern dictator in some country, someplace? If you ask them who owns the earth, what do you think they would say? I guess an easy answer. Well, the state does. And the state just parcels out benevolence to who they will. We saw that in the life of Saul earlier on. One of God's goals with Pharaoh is to teach him that he does not own the earth. And my friend, every time there's a family that lays claim to the property of their own family, their children, and their own goods, their own land, their own means of production, every time there's a family that does that, it's a stick in the eye of the status who don't get it that the earth is the Lord's. Every time. I hope this is news to you here. It sure was news to me as I studied this. Like, man, I always thought this is kind of like a general conflict between the two to see who's stronger. And that did happen. But there's an educational program going on here. Pharaoh was going to get educated as to who the earth really belongs to. It's the same lesson that our status need to know today. Same one. You know what? What would our country look like? What would the world look like if every person in power understood that the earth is the Lord's? What would things look like? Number three. Why the war against the family via inheritance taxes? Because Christianity presents another civil authority, a state within a state. Now here's where, this number three, here's where we're going to really fall off the wagon here. Here's where I'm going to lose pretty much all of my, of North American Christianity here. Well, listen to this from R.J. Rushdoony. The Atheism of the Early Church. Some of you have seen this book, and I want to talk about it here. The Atheism of the Early Church. Peter's message to the elders and scribes recorded in Acts 4:12 best sums up the conflict we are involved in today. In Acts 4:12, you may remember, neither is there salvation in any other, for there is none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. It is important for us to understand the context of this verse. With that statement, Peter effectually issued a spiritual declaration of war against the Roman Empire. You see where I'm losing pretty much everybody at this point? We're kind of told that the object of the early church was to get along with the Roman Empire. We can all be friends, can't we? When Augustus Caesar took the helm in Rome and had consolidated his power, a great celebration was held throughout the Roman Empire. It was called the Advent Celebration. A very significant term and a very religious one. It was the Advent celebration because Augustus Caesar had come in all the fullness of his power. The heralds were sent to the far corners of the Roman Empire with a great Advent proclamation. And here's what it was. There is none other name under heaven whereby men may be saved than the name of Caesar Augustus. You think Peter self-consciously knew what he was talking about and what he was saying? Do you think Caesar Augustus sees that proclamation by Peter as a declaration of war? I really don't think he was saying, why can't we all just get along? It was the proclamation of Caesar, the state, as man's savior. We can understand then why conflict between Christ and the Caesars was inevitable, why the church went through all the troubles it did, year in, year out, and why men were martyred for the faith. It was because of this question, who is Lord or sovereign, who is the Savior? The modern state is saying again, as the Caesars did of old, we are the Lord, we are the sovereigns over creation. The words sovereign and Lord are identical. They are different words for the same thing. We cannot confess the sovereignty of the state and the sovereignty of Christ. We must affirm, Dr. Rustuni goes on to say, as the early church did, that Christ is Lord over Caesar. Every man, every institution, every civil government, every school, all things must in due time acknowledge the lordship of the sovereignty of Christ, for there is salvation in no other. That's from R.J. Rustuni, The Atheism of the Early Church. And the case is still not clear. From Robin Phillips. The Roman state would certainly never have persecuted the Christians in the worship of Jesus. If it was simply one more private cult to choose from. Now we're going to stop there for a minute. Let's ask this question. Did the Roman state persecute all religions? The answer is no way. They had ISIS worship going on. They had Sibylline worship going on. They had all kinds of worship going on. And their policy was, when they took over an area, to let the people just go ahead and worship the way they were. They just had to, in many cases, sacrifice to the genius, or the, if you will, the deity of the Caesars. But there were more religions under the Roman Empire than you can possibly count. Why, then, persecute the Christians? Why? It's because they represented a state within a state. It's because they challenged the sovereignty of the Caesar, which the other ones did not. They were pantheists, multi-theists, if you will. We can worship God, we can worship our God, we can worship Caesar. It doesn't matter to us, and the Christians wouldn't do it. On the contrary, Christians were seen as subversive, precisely because their religion was in competition with the political religion of Rome. See, we're told in order to be good Christians, we have to get beside the political religion of the state today. No wonder we don't see persecution like they saw it. Christianity offered a vision for how society as a whole should look, as well as showing how an individual looks within that society and how he should behave. The gospel had as much to say about politics, how nations should be governed, as it did about our own personal lives. As Stephen Perks points out, as long as Roman citizens practiced the religion of Rome, they were free to practice whatever cult they wished. The cult of Jesus Christ included. It was the early church's refusal to limit the Christian faith to the status of a cult that brought Christians in conflict with Rome. The practice of Christianity as a religion and not a cult brought the church into direct conflict with the religion of Rome. This was a clash of religions, not cults. Do you understand the difference? Cults, schmaltz, worship whoever you want. And the early Christians said, no, this is an issue of sovereignty here. And you, Caesar, and that was what's insulting to the Caesars. You, Caesar, are a subject of this Christ just like the rest of us. And on that point, my friends, it was on that point that they were martyred, killed, and destroyed. It was on that point. It was on a point that we could argue was actually political. Now, it wasn't political in the normal sense, obviously. It wasn't a mere political point. It was a point that politics came under, if you will. Christ is sovereign. It was on that point that they were burned and faced the lions. Let's not forget that. So, that's why the war against the family via inheritance taxes, they represent a state within a state, another authority, if you will. And if you're a good old-fashioned statist, you can't take it. How does the state war against the family? How do they do it? Through plundering their wealth and killing and driving off their leadership. Did you ever notice this? Look what happened with David. David's got a little conflict going on with Saul. We've talked about Saul before. An excellent statist. And David went thence to Mizpah of Moab. But look what's going to happen here. And he said to the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me. And he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in the hold. I think a question should come up right now. Didn't David have a job back home with the sheep? Wasn't his dad somewhat wealthy? He was wealthy enough to send food to the boys who were fighting the Philistines. And look what they've been reduced to. Going and pleading to the king of Moab just to have a place to stay. See, that's how status attack the family. They drive off their leadership and they steal their wealth. How bad off do you think David's parents had to have been to go and plead for a place to stay with the king of Moab? See, Saul was at war with the family. He was a good statist. Statists can't help. They cannot help themselves. They will war against the family on every turn. What aspect of the family responsibility is lost when the family is deprived of property? The ability to teach. Now you're going to say, hey, Joel, you're reading into it now. You mean to tell me if the family is deprived of property that they can't teach the next generation? You need to tell me that. You mean to tell me that property is that important? Well, let's see. Of course, this is why we have question and answers afterwards. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and these words that I command you today shall be in your heart. And not just your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. So it's supposed to be in your heart and your children's heart, right? Now, how are you going to do that? Well, we're told, you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and you shall be as frontless between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. So let me ask a question. Let's take away all the property. How would that verse be rewritten if we took away all their property? They don't have a house anymore. They don't have gates. They don't have protection. They don't have a place to lie down. They don't have a place to rise up. I'd like to see how this verse would be rewritten. I don't think you're going to be able to do it. Here Moses is directly connecting the ability to own property with the ability to teach the next generation. No wonder we're under the threat of inheritance taxes. When the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers to give you large and beautiful cities which you did not build, houses full of all good things which you did not fill, hewn out walls which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, when you have eaten and are full, then beware lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house and from the house of bondage. You know, I was reading that and thinking about that. You know, in our Christian circles today, we got the Christian Marxism going on, don't we? You know, the problem is that we have too much, right? We're all fat, we have too much. But you know what the answer is right here? This speaks to that, doesn't it? Be careful when you have all these things. And our Christian Marxist friends would say, well, make sure you give them away and take a vow of poverty. But that's not the answer here. The answer here that Moses gives is you better remember. See, again, Moses here connecting blessing to the family with property. And the worry is, when you get full and you forget God, not to give away your property, but to remember where it came from and to thank God for it. In the end, inheritance taxes are to the family in death what income taxes are to the family in life. Deadly, debilitating, discouraging, demoralizing. There are all these. All these are a direct attack on the family. And I thank you very much for your kind attention here tonight. Who has the first question? And remember, we have to, yeah, we have to speak into the mic. We did talk about me repeating the question, but there's two problems with that. The first one is that I'll do that for the first or second question, and then I'll start forgetting to do it. And I've seen people who are much more accomplished speakers than I do the exact same thing. But the second thing is a tendency for the speaker to cheat a little bit, right? The speaker repeats the question, and for some reason, it's a little bit easier to answer the way the speaker repeats it than it was when the questioner asked the question. For some reason, that can happen. Yes, Marilyn.
You said that Christianity says the leaders have to submit to God. Is this thing on? Okay. So how is that different than Islam? I'm not exactly sure what they say. They say you have to submit to Allah or we'll chop your head off.
Right.
But I don't know. Nobody seems to be mad at Muslims. Like, they treat them like a cult. They don't really seem to have the same hatred for the Muslims as they do the Christians. Am I not getting... That's what I'm thinking. I don't...
Yeah, we can't... It's one of our problems... And I have the same problem. We do expect the enemies of Christ to be rational. But if they were rational, they'd bow the knee to Christ. They're more upset at a Christian saying, you need to bow the knee to Christ, and we're gonna try to persuade you to do that. They're more upset at that Christian than the Muslim who says, I'm going to chop your head off if you don't bow the knee towards Mecca. I mean, it's completely irrational, but that's just the way it is. I have a couple articles. I didn't really have time to mess with them tonight. I got this out of the Wall Street Journal today called Brooklyn's Other Jackie Robinson. And I am somewhat of a, I've been a Jackie Robinson fan, if you will, for quite some time. By the way, it was Jackie Robinson that broke the whole color barrier thing. I mean, we want to go back to the so-called civil rights movements of the 1960s. But I got news for you. It was Jackie Robinson, Branch Rickey, that made the civil rights marches possible. And, you know, we always have the state jumping into the parade late and saying, boy, if it wouldn't be for us from passing all our laws, we wouldn't have integration. Now, it was Jackie Robinson, Branch Rickey that made it possible in the beginning. And this is kind of a big thing with me because the whole team sport thing interests me a lot, and I believe that team sports are only possible in a Christian context, because the Church of Jesus Christ comes along and makes the idea of a group possible. It really didn't exist, the idea, until the Church came along, and team sports are not possible, I don't believe, consistently in a non-Christian culture, consistently over time. That's why the original Olympics were the team sports in the original Olympics when they were worshiping all these multi-gods. Now they're all individual sports. All right, enough of that. I will get myself in big trouble if I go down this road, but I sure would like to. In any case, what the article talks about here, called Brooklyn's Other Jackie Robinson by William McGurn in the Wall Street Journal, talks about a school that was put in on Old Ebbets Field, where Jackie Robinson first played baseball. Of course, the Brooklyn Dodgers no longer play there. They're not even Brooklyn anymore. They're in Los Angeles. And he talks about how poor that school, that public school, is doing. And the numbers are just awful. And he asks the question, would Jackie Robinson approve of the school that's supposedly teaching children in his name? And he goes on to say that so many private people have actually done such a fantastic job of teaching even inner city children. If you want someone to look up, Marva Collins. I don't know if you've ever heard of her or not. She was a woman that got fed up with the public education system in Chicago. Began teaching children, inner city children, in her own house on her second floor. Tremendous results with very little money. Almost none. Now, I'm speaking to this issue of rationality here. If, you know, with all the talk about education that we hear from our secular people, and all about the next generation. Oh, they need to learn how to read, and they need to be educated. Don't you think we might look at Marva Collins, or we might look at that horrible school there and say, hey, you know, maybe it's not working? Not at all. Not at all. They have no interest with all their talk in actually educating anyone. They are interested in their own power, their own bureaucracy, and their own ability to keep the people stupid. And keep them, and very stupid people, this is the key to democracy, my friends. Very stupid people vote for very stupid people. And if they can keep us stupid enough, they'll stay in power forever. We expect them to be rational. What a disappointment. Won't happen. Yes, we have a question.
I got a quick question first. Let's talk about avoiding inheritance taxes. You'll hear about setting up a trust. You'll hear about selling your property to one of your or all of your children for a dollar. What are some and Ken Souter, if you want to chime in on this, feel free, or anybody else for that matter. But could you just touch on that for a second?
Well, clearly, you should do whatever you can to avoid any type of tax. Now, before anybody gets upset and thinks that I'm going up against Romans 13, you know who the most effective people at avoiding any type of tax? Are the people that institute the taxes. Remember Geithner? He didn't pay taxes. He became Treasury Secretary. So there'd be plenty of Christians who would have a problem with what I just said, have no problem at all with Geithner. So I'm not the only one saying this. I'm quite in the mainstream, quite frankly, for if I was a godless man and didn't care about that kind of stuff. Your family inheritance goes to your children. Biblically speaking, I haven't studied this as much as some have, but I don't see another source for your family inheritance other than your own family. I don't see it. And anyone who takes it, and when the state comes along and takes it away, it's theft.
No, I understand all that. I'm not really addressing your question.
What I'm arguing against is that mentality that says, well, since the state says that we get it, that then let's be a good Christian and pay every dime of it. Okay, another that. Yeah, beyond that, you have a couple choices. Don't deal in cash. Just deal in goods. Try to get off the radar. Ken, tell us how it can be done legally.
First of all,
there you go.
The federal inheritance taxes now are pretty high. It's not going to hit a lot of us. It will hit those who have big estates, farms, those sorts of things. There's really not a lot of ways you can escape it. Trusts don't necessarily escape taxation. A trust is just because you want to put somebody in trust, somebody to manage the money for somebody else. But the only thing here in Pennsylvania would be the Pennsylvania death taxes, and that depends on the relative that's getting the money. So if it would go to anybody other than a spouse, I think it's like 2.8%, something like that at this point. But as far as the federal estate tax, I think it's like $6 million right now. It used to be much lower, and there for a time, you know, it was very low. But right now, it's significantly high. It's not going to hit a lot of people. Taxes in general, coming over tonight, I was talking to Rich of a couple of great tax strategies that you can use. They're totally legal. So, yeah, I mean, I do that all the time, try to keep money in God's people's hands.
That's all we want to know.
Well, strangely enough, it's different for each person depending upon where you're at. I can't make a blanket statement. This one might work for you. This one might not work for you. But if you want to see me afterwards, I'd be happy to talk to you. No charge.
Okay, so if I heard you correctly, Ken, there are strategies that address what Toby's saying. We might not know what they are, but they do exist.
So the very wealthy, I mean, like you say, God Geithner and these guys, they know. They've created the laws. They know the loopholes.
Right.
That's what I do. I don't have many $6 million clients, but...
Sure.
But there are Pennsylvania inheritance taxes and those sorts. There are some things you can do to reduce your taxes.
I would encourage all of you to do whatever you can to reduce your taxes. I would certainly encourage that. Give them to the people that deserve them, not the ones that don't. Jeremiah.
I was going to ask the same question that Toby did, but one strategy I heard about was taking advantage of the gift tax or gift exemptions and starting to gift your children, you know, maximum allowable gifts, you know, starting early.
Yeah.
Maybe age 13 or 15.
Right, sort of give it away while you're alive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So perhaps, Ken, you could speak.
Ken, what's that number? Is that 14,000 you're allowed to give?
14,000.
Yeah. So the strategy is to, while you're alive, instead of just giving it all away after you're gone, while you're alive, start to give it away. $14,000 a year per child that's not taxed.
Correct.
And the other benefit of that I can see is, I mean, is it fair to say that your children potentially could use that money, you know, earlier? You know, let's say they get married, you know, they want to buy their first house debt-free. I mean, so if you wait until, you know, you die,
mm-hmm.
they may not, you know, they may need the money earlier. So it's
sure.
kind of maybe a win-win. I don't know.
One thing on that, a lot of people sell their houses for a dollar. That only transfers the cost basis to the next person that's getting it. So eventually, right. when that house is sold, they're paying the taxes. You're not only giving them a house, you're giving them a big tax liability.
Right.
If you give it to them at death, that tax basis steps up and they get it free of taxation. So, you know, before you do anything, you really should talk to somebody about your own individual situation to see if it really makes sense. People do a lot of things that they hear at McDonald's and this type of thing, and a bunch of guys get together, and they really don't know what they're talking about. And so, you know, talk to somebody who really knows what they're talking about. My question is, I've always seen the issue here is one of dominion. The state fears the power of godly people in accumulating and passing on wealth, and what that does to extend the kingdom of God on earth. What say you about that?
Generation to generation.
Sure.
I mean, that could really snowball something.
Yeah, it wouldn't. I mean, the numbers are tremendous. Grandchildren, great-grandchildren.
I mean, think of it. You start off with an inheritance of $2 or $3 million. I mean, then you go on to the next generation, you could buy over a couple dozen towns.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is one of the things that is kind of maddening about this. And I'll tell you why. Because the power in the family, in property, is beyond any of us, I think, to even comprehend. I don't think we can think of it. But we've grown comfortable with this inheritance tax thing and this attack on the family through forcible taxation. And you mentioned dominion. We had to give up the idea of dominion in order to make peace with forced taxation.
Exactly.
That's what we had to do, and we've given up that idea. And we now are, Christianity is just all within me, and it's just me and Jesus. And we've left the culture alone. I'll mention it again, when a prominent theologian and Bible teacher says, I don't care about the culture, what he's just said is, I don't care about my neighbor.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, this is not rocket science here. The culture is your neighbor. And that is a mainstream thing. And to your point, Ken, we've got to get back the idea of dominion. If we don't, we will continue to make our peace. You know, it's just like we've made our peace with the overpopulation theories. And since we've made our peace with the overpopulation theories, we've made our peace with an anti-children agenda that has now spilled over into abortion. We would never have gotten into this abortion thing if we would not have made our peace with saying, okay, you know what? Yeah, children really are a blight, and we really are overpopulated. So many things we needed, we gave it up, And now we have a, we gave up the root, and now we have a problem with the fruit. We got to get that root back again. Got to.
So, another question: how do we deal with politicians? I mean, I always see these are great things, and people get together and they talk about all this stuff. But ultimately, unless we're on the inside, we're not going to make any changes. We need to be involved in the process in large numbers to make changes. I noticed that the left, they just persevere at this on and on and on. They'll work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to get in political office so that they can implement their agenda on us. And yet, I have a hard time finding anybody to work at the polls. So there's a component of this that education is wonderful. I'm all for it. I think it's a great thing. We need it. But at some point, we need to step up and get involved.
Yeah, how can we get past this? We're outgunned, if you will. I want to actually answer that in two phases. One of them is one I mentioned before. Back when I was a good little Republican, I one time worked an April 15th. And it was kind of interesting working in April 15th at the post office. I was a good Republican. I was trying to get people to register Republican. I thought this would be a pretty fertile field here. People rushing in with their taxes and, you know, sweating it out. And it's April 15th. I think I did it right. Here, would you like to register to vote? Put an end to this stuff. An interesting thing happened that night. A bunch of socialists got there. Did I mention this one before? Okay. Very interesting. Me and another guy and I were working it. Handing stuff out, talking to people, right? A bunch of socialists showed up. They were socialists. They had no shame about it at all. And they set up in front of us. They started handing out literature. They weren't there 5 minutes until the media showed up, started interviewing them. And they were pals from way back. I mean, they're gabbing about other places they've been, right? Back and forth, right? And then the media got what they wanted, and they left. All the socialists left that fast, and me and the other guy and I were still there doing our thing. Because we're so outgunned, it sure does look like the other side is working harder than we are. That night, it looked like the socialists were out there, and where was anybody else? Not even on the radar screen. I still get angry thinking about that. The only thing that was good about it was the other guy that I was working with that night was pretty sharp, and he kept on jabbing the socialists all night long, which was kind of fun to watch, and somewhat therapeutic for me at least. The other thing is, and this is why I go back to this all the time, Ken, and we've got our politicians who are ridiculous, and we've got our people in the White House who are ridiculous as other people are running for it. And I've got to say again that these politicians have not done one single thing that the Church of Jesus Christ has not given them permission and encouragement to do. That was one of my points that I actually dropped out on tonight. And so I actually believe that our battle has to start within the church. And we're not appreciated there. You guys that attend the Independence Reformed Bible Church, you know, I mean, we're not even worth stepping on, right? We're so small and tiny, right? I mean, who are we? And yet I know from what I'm hearing back from some other people that it's already known that we're there and some of the stuff that we're saying. And there's been some decent accusations that have come against us. None of them true, which matters not at all. And I'm talking about accusations from other churches. And you guys know that I said in the beginning from IRBC that we're not going to have problems with the pagans. They don't care about us. We're too small. The people we're going to have problems with is other Bible churches. And that's exactly the way it's worked out. And I got to say, Ken, we're getting no place until we can challenge those churches. We're just not. And that is that. I'll say this too, just real quickly. I know we have other questions. Real quickly, and it's getting late. But here's the thing. When we started the Mid-Atlantic Forever Mason Society, John, you were there. Toby, you were there. We started the society to help out churches because we thought churches would want to know what the Bible has to say about politics, about society. You know, they just had a lack of information. Boy, did we ever find out fast. They wanted absolutely nothing, nothing to do with us. See, here's the thing. We have three institutions. We have the state with the power, has the guns. And we have individual families standing up against them. But we don't have the church. It seems to me that, humanly speaking, until the church combines with the families to challenge the state, that the state will move on just as it is right now, obliterating everything in its path. And those families that stand up are often castigated by the very church that should be protecting them. That seriously has to stop. A lot more to be said on that. I saw another question. It was last year.
Okay. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. A lot of inheritances are ruinations. And so how do you reconcile that with that verse? I've seen in my own life money's given to people which have made them lazy and irresponsible, sort of like the prodigal son scenario. So any comments you can offer on that?
Sure. This is the tangled web, shall we say, that we've begun to weave for ourselves. We have in our modern situation, it seems to me that we've often have a problem giving away our physical inheritance, because years ago we already gave away our spiritual inheritance when we turned those children over to be educated by godless pagans. And that's really where it starts. We cannot expect the next generation who've been educated by people who hate Christ to responsibly utilize the money that we leave them. We can't even expect it. And I'm not saying that's the process every single time. We know in the case of the prodigal son, we know what happened there, and he wasted it. That's true. But in God's law, the father can withhold inheritance. And you know, there's one law that everybody makes fun of. It's the rebellious son law. You know what I'm talking about, right? And everybody makes fun of that. Even Christians make fun of that. Oh, what a stupid law. You mean you stone your own son? Oh, that's terrible. Well, if you read the law, the son gets a trial before the elders, and he's accused of being a drunkard and a glutton. And just a problem. And the kind of kid that we would put in jail so he could become a better criminal, and by the time he's dead, he will have killed two or three people, raped 15 more, and stolen $1 million, and cost the state $2 million to house him. That's the kind of guy it's talking about in Deuteronomy 32 there. I believe it's 32. You know what? If we implemented that, there wouldn't be too many deadbeats to hand our money to. They wouldn't be in the land of the living. But of course we know better. We'll put them in jail when they can become real good criminals. So that's how we saw that. We weave this web, and we do it all the time. It's so easy to do. We compromise on God's law here and there and there and there and there. And then it gets really big at the end. And we're like, what do we do about this? And the answer is, well, what did we do? What did we do to get here? It's a fair question and a good one. One the prodigal son's father definitely considered, I'm sure. I have no doubt about that. Well, I want to thank you very much for your kind attention here tonight.